Hi, and welcome to the Friday Coffee Meetup Podcast for Friday, May 1st, 2020. On today's virtual meetup, we'll hear from Kwame Olmer on regulatory and investment intersection for healthcare startups. The Friday Coffee Meetup Podcast is brought to you by Echo Factory, a Pasadena-based marketing and advertising agency that specializes helping healthcare, consumer goods, clean tech, and aerospace companies achieve rapid sustainable growth. Echo Factory CEO Mike Schaefer is a co-founder and organizer of Friday Coffee Meetup. If you're interested in how Echo Factory can help your company achieve rapid sustainable growth, you can learn more at echo-factory.com. Every week, the Friday Coffee Meetup brings together innovators, startups, investors, tech companies, and entrepreneurs at the cross-campus co-working space in Pasadena. You can learn more about upcoming meetups and how you can attend in person at FridayCoffeeMeetup.com. Now, here's Kwame with this week's presentation.
I also put in the link for an exciting event that's coming up, and I'm going to stop sharing now and turn it over to Minnie Ingersoll, who's going to talk to us about the Pasadena Innovation Extravazumba. No, Extravazumba. So I'm going to stop sharing and turn it over to Minnie. If you can talk about your really cool event. I'm so excited for this.
Thanks, Christy. That's perfect. Yeah, I just wanted to really put in a plug for this event that we're having on May 22nd. It's a Zoom event, as these things are nowadays. But it's got a lot of the same purpose as the Friday Coffee Meetup. We've got a bunch of VCs and a bunch of founders and a bunch of sort of people in the Pasadena tech ecosystem all getting together, very informal. We have 30 speakers speaking for 2 minutes each. And it's a lot of people that you've seen at the Friday Coffee series. So Chung from Upfront, Kwame's partner, Jay Goss, number of folks just kind of to facilitate everyone getting to know each other. And it's an Eventbrite, it's open to the public. It's like the Friday Coffee Meetup. We can have 500 people join. And yes, like you referenced, it's called a extravaganzuma or a Zuma Vaganza, whatever you prefer. But it'll be really fun and we'd love to see folks there.
Fantastic, Minnie. Thanks so much for organizing that. And I think I read, are you going to be the MC for that?
I am the MC, which just means I'm cutting people off if they talk too much. That's mostly what my job is.
That's fantastic. Well, we'll look forward to seeing your face on May 22nd. At the event, check the link in the chat window for the Eventbrite. All right, thank you. With that, I'm so excited to introduce this morning Kwame Olmer. He's here to talk to us about regulatory and investment intersections in healthcare startups. He has personally evaluated over 1,000 medical technologies for the FDA and has helped more than 100 startups through their own MedTech regulatory path, which I imagine must be incredibly complicated. He is a partner at Wavemaker 360 Health. He's also a member of Tech Coast Angels and is a principal at Olmer Ventures. So we are so excited to have you here with us this morning, Kwame. Welcome. I'm going to turn it over to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Christy, and good morning, everyone. And thanks again for the opportunity, and specifically thanks to my friend and colleague, Evan Sang, for introducing me to this great community. I had no idea it was over 7,000 participants. I'm going to share my screen so that we can get started more formally. My journey in the healthcare field began 18 years ago. I started at the FDA and was evaluating medical technology applications, interfacing and meeting with CEOs of early stage companies and more mature firms that you've heard of, like Medtronic and Boston Scientific. I served in a range of roles. And towards the end of my career, I realized that I had been seeing companies that it received a significant amount of funding to get to a meaningful milestone, which was one of the last steps before they could realize revenue and really take off as a company and get a sense of product market fit. After my time at the FDA, which was 12 years, I took a role at Danaher. Danaher is a company that's actually the 8th largest medical device company in the world. And I served as a vice president of regulatory and quality, working to get products on the market throughout the world in areas like North America, Europe. We started a journey to get the product on the market in China. And for the last 3 years, I've been a regulatory consultant working with companies that are trying to navigate the FDA. And I'm fortunate enough to serve as a venture partner in Wavemaker 360 Health, which is an early stage healthcare fund. And so I'm delighted to spend a few moments to talk to you about the intersection between regulations and investments in healthcare. And hopefully you'll come away with the appreciation that I have that regulations can unlock revenue and be super cool. These are the ways you can get in touch with me, my email on the regulatory side and through Wavemaker, which is based in Pasadena. So I'm a member of the Pasadena tribe. So we're going to talk about how I view regulatory strategy, and we'll talk a bit about examples of where this is playing out today, particularly in this COVID crisis, and certain guidances that may be top of mind for some of you. I see some of my colleagues from the ecosystem on, so I look forward to engaging in a conversation after this presentation. And thank you, Christy, for moderating, so I don't have to worry about that. So we're going to talk about broadly the role regulatory plays in a startup's life, but this could apply if you're diligencing for M&A deals. Some of these principles, many of these principles will apply if you are engaged as a mature company and you're thinking about some of these meaningful milestones as you launch a product. So I use the diamond strategy when thinking about regulatory issues. So we're going to talk through these topics. What arena are you playing in? For most of us on this call, you're looking to launch a product in the United States. You may or may not be regulated by the FDA, and we'll talk a bit about wellness products that FDA has decided are going to exercise enforcement discretion, but still you need to think about some of these issues. What vehicles, what government applications are you going to use? Some of us in this COVID time are looking at tapping into some of these NIH dollars or BARDA dollars to accelerate a test kit that they're developing, as an example. But some of us just need to get through a traditional FDA application. We'll talk about timelines. What's the regulatory timeline? What's the clinical timeline? What are some key considerations as you factor in how long it'll take realistically to get through the FDA? And then differentiation. And I'll highlight and talk about what you should consider transitioning from doing something in-house to farming it out to a consultant to hiring a full-time staff and the staging or considerations for that. And finally, economic logic. We'll talk about not only speed to market, but what most founders, based on some data from Silicon Valley Bank, consider reasonable in terms of valuing their company after reaching a meaningful milestone. So what does it mean to get pre-submission feedback, and how do you value that as a meaningful milestone when you're talking to investors? So the arena, the three things that I think about when you're considering the market to enter is the indications for use, the product description with the key features and the claims. We start there because no matter what regulatory body, what Ministry of Health you're going to be dealing with, you have to have those fundamentals pinned down, written on paper, to decide and understand how that governmental body, that Ministry of Health, the FDA, will regulate and what application is necessary just to begin building out your regulatory and clinical program. And these are typical questions that are top of mind for companies. You know, and this is 90% of the questions that I think are critical in the earliest stages for an assessment of an acquisition or building out a company. What is the application? How long would it really take for FDA approval? And how many patients will I really need to get through the FDA? And how do I prepare for a meeting to clarify any of these issues regarding getting through the FDA? The regulatory landscape is going to be important. And in the environment we're in, it is an amazing time. FDA is publishing an average of 2 to 3 guidances every week related to COVID, in addition to the more standard guidances for products that will be of interest to you, that may be relevant to what you're trying to produce. And to get a sense of the landscape, here are some key resources that I look to when working with companies. We talked about the guidance that may be available. There's a wonderful resource on the FDA's website where you can do key resource search. You can look up your product via key resource via keyword, and you can get a primer. If you're a CEO or a vice president of marketing, I would recommend not getting into any level of detail with these resources. But if you want to get a primer on how FDA thinks about medical products, specifically medical devices, you can go to Device Advice, and it should take no more than an hour of your time just to get level set so you can have intelligent conversations with consultants that you may be working with. And the big kahuna right now is the emergency use authorization. If you're building a ventilator, if you're building a test kit, if you're engaged in perhaps an ophthalmic diagnostic to help screen for COVID infection, you may want to consider an emergency use authorization. If you have a wellness product that is treating people for helping to treat people dealing with anxiety, there is guidance relevant to you. And there's some information on how you can think about what you can and cannot say. PubMed is a resource that if you have any rigor or clinical data supporting your product and the claims you want to make is where you might want to go. And then finally, on the post-market side, I would think through and research the safety events that have been triggered or been made public regarding the device type or general area that you're in. So you can get a sense of the level of activity going on and the compliance risk associated with your general device area. Competitors is another. And then you can actually conduct reasonable informational interviews with consultants to get a better sense of the regulatory landscape. So before COVID and even now, digital health is a booming area. Some of you are in this digital health space. Some of you are in the what is called wellness space. You know, it's funny, 5 years ago, wellness wasn't a term, but now you can go to an innovation space like Scale Health in LA, and there are over 100 members, and probably 60% of those members are in the wellness or digital health space. And the FDA has promoted, published a lot of guidance to help you understand the preclinical and clinical data needed to support an application, no matter where you play in this digital health spectrum. So in terms of vehicles, I'm going to talk about a few just for context of the timelines associated with getting through the FDA. We have a regulated product. For those in the therapeutic space, I see one of my colleagues is on in the therapeutic space. The NDA can take well over a year. It's called a new drug application. And the data set is often in the thousands of patients to evaluate the product. On the other end of the spectrum, an emergency use application, if you're fighting this COVID pandemic and it's a meaningful diagnostic or therapeutic in the device side, the requirements can be anywhere from 40 to 60 patient samples. In the process, from the time you have a final finished device to the time you have your EUA, could be anywhere from 1 to 2 months. The more traditional applications that I've dealt with for the 18 years I've been in this space are 510Ks, and they can, on the low end, take anywhere from 6 to 9 months for the regulatory process and require no patients. And on the long end of the spectrum, it could take 18 months. And we can talk about some of the reasons that that is. So I wanted to talk about the EUA and give some color as to why it can take anywhere from 1 to 2 months. So from the time you think you need or an applicant or eligible for the EUA, you will contact the FDA. In a few days, they'll come back to you, maybe less than a few days, and give you a template to fill out for initial discussions so that you can clarify and complete the information needed for a full application. And this application is anywhere from a few pages, is approximately a few pages, contrasted to a typical FDA application for a typical medical device, can it be anywhere from 100 to 300 pages. So it's a highly streamlined process to get through and get authorized to sell your product as you're fighting COVID. There'll be some back and forth, and quite candidly, there'll be some time on the company side to conduct the preclinical and clinical tests needed to complete the application. Once you've drafted that application, it'll be finally approved by the FDA. You can submit it, and the FDA will take approximately 2 weeks to review and issue a final decision. So in that way, if you add up all those times, if you started, let's say, in mid-April, you could be done and authorized to sell your product as late as June, mid-June. I wanted to spend a bit more time on COVID because it may be of interest to some of the members. And some of these issues are relaxations of existing guidances or data requirements for companies who have been regulated for years and device types that have been regulated for years. So for clinical trials, the bottom line up front, this particular guidance that was issued about a week ago, 2 weeks ago, talks about the contingencies that are in place for studies that have been put on pause for applications pending the FDA. This is a really interesting guidance that was issued about a week and a half ago that allows claims related to COVID for companies looking to treat anxiety disorders. And this is allowing companies to promote these claims and get on the market even before a typical FDA 510K application. It's an exciting time to be in that space, and a couple companies have already launched digital health companies to treat psychiatric disorders using this guidance as a justification. Essentially, the FDA says that if you label a respirator or a mask properly, you can forego the typical NIOSH certification and certain amounts of testing and certain regulations related to good manufacturing practices for this device type. So the regulatory burden and requirements have been significantly lower for masks and respirators. And quite candidly, that's one of the reasons why you may be seeing the ability to buy respirators on your Instagram feed, which is something that we've never seen before. It's typically a B2B sale. One of the areas I'm working in intensely right now is the diagnostic space. And again, the data set needed to get an EUA can be less than 100 samples. I know a company based in LA in the telemedicine space. We've seen a proliferation of telemedicine. And the exciting news is the FDA has affirmed that during this crisis, telemedicine is not regulated. And I think it's an exciting time to be active in actually trying to help reach patients. One of the companies we invested in, Advocate, sits squarely in this position of being able to really expand their connecting of therapists to patients during this COVID crisis. So many companies are still needing to talk to the FDA in what's called a pre-submission meeting. And we'll talk about practically some of the points to consider. as you're timing your engagement with the FDA. And with that, let's just dive in. So should you talk to the FDA? If you want to clarify your pathway, and you have investors, quite frankly, have strongly requested or demanded this, this is a great opportunity, provided you have the time in your roadmap to get the feedback and obviously execute on it. So typically, it's a question of this particular guidance calls for a 200-patient study, and our biostatistician has designed a study for 100 patients. And your question to the FDA is, is that 100-patient study acceptable for this application? If you are willing to take the risk of conducting a study that may not be acceptable, you don't need to go through the pre-submission, but it's usually recommended for companies who are really advancing novel technologies with limited predicates to determine the clinical data set needed. In this process, from beginning to end, the formal process will take 75 days. We talked about clinical considerations. These are the ones that are most important. One is the duration, which will be driven by the study design, the endpoints, effectiveness, and safety, and really having the very best biostatistician on your team to design something that is of the appropriate amount of rigor with the right p-values, hypotheses, et cetera, that are mapped to literature in the space so that you know that you're doing a best of breed, high quality, randomized control study, for example. And we'll talk about this in a little bit more depth in a couple slides. Understanding the cash to execute, whether you're going to try and manage a modest study on your own with a person who's has that experience, maybe functioning as your clinical trials manager, or you're going to contract with a CRO, whether it's a boutique firm or a major organization, a large CRO, depending on the size of your study, and quite candidly, the type of rigor you want in that space. So how do you prepare? These meetings, some may consider this good, will for the foreseeable future be via Zoom. And so the travel dollars are cut out. But practically speaking, a company wants to focus on minimizing page count. The spirit of these meetings are to address 1 to 3 critical questions and get those answered in a very focused manner. So it doesn't require a 150-page tome. Practically speaking, you'll get a sense of the decision makers in that room from the first line supervisor to the division director who will be ultimately signing off on the feedback. And it's really important as a best practice to, during that 1 hour meeting, having a facilitator, someone who's focused on making sure that your key questions have been asked and answered, and there's ample time for conversation. So we'll talk a bit about controlling the narrative during this meeting. Principally speaking, the communication should be consistent, concise, and complete, and should be very focused so that the reviewer is looking at the information they need to make the decision or make the recommendation. So if you have a question about testing to a particular standard, you can have, for example, a clear table of where you deviated from a standard, why you deviated, so that you are feeding this reviewer your opinion based on the science as to why you deviated from a standard and asking for his or her buy-off. One typical question is, as you have iterated on your product, does the FDA agree that testing on a prior version is adequate to support the product that you want to market and is this will be the subject of your application? So in many product financials, a company will have headcount they want to bring on from consultants to full-time. And generally speaking, med tech companies, which is type of company I deal with a lot, stay light and lead up into and including the seed round, and then go from consultants to full-time headcount during that Series A, and even more significantly through to the B. And that's prudent in most cases. Some of the typical hires early on will be your commercial success person, vice president of marketing, vice president of sales, an engineering lead, chief technology officer. But you may consult out on quality, regulatory, some of these other features until you get your first, you know, 3 to 5 million. So we're going to talk about this and dive in. And this is one of the reasons why regulatory can be so sexy. The economic logic for having a really streamlined regulatory process. One is that speed to market. The regulatory process, like we said, if it's efficient, can be anywhere from 6 to 9 months. If it's inefficient or complex, it can be, you know, multiples of years. And to get that done for most early stage companies, unless it's a particularly novel, complex technology, you may want to bring on in-house as one of your first hires a mid-level regulatory person who can grow with the company and help you put in place those SOPs, those templates that are going to be necessary as a requirement to selling your product. And what's the value? What's the amount of capital that companies are willing to invest to get to these meaningful milestones associated with regulatory affairs or regulatory strategy? Well, one is written feedback from the FDA. And if you look at some of the data from Silicon Valley Bank and having worked with a range of these companies, that investment attributing to preclinical and maybe some modest clinical can be anywhere from $500K to $1 million in additional capital. Sometimes it's at C, sometimes it's during that A round. The clinical trials, that value, that perceived value for a novel product, de novo or PMA, can be multiples in the millions. And this is when the company foresees an M&A event after completing that 200, 250,000 patient clinical trial that may be needed for de novo or PMA submission. So that's why there's so much value that could be put into a company in expectation of that 5X acquisition after hitting that clinical trial endpoint. And then finally, the clinical trial completion for 510K, the evaluation may be more modest, because typically for 510K devices, there's going to be a couple of years of revenue generation before an acquisition event. De novo granting a PMA approval, when you hit that milestone, companies may have had upwards of $50 million invested by stakeholders. So wow, we've covered a lot. It's been my pleasure to go through this information. And this is the fun part where we get to have a conversation. And I'm looking forward to it, and hopefully it'll be of value. And I think at this point, I'm going to put up my contact information so that you
can. That would be great. Let's put that back up and start some Q&A.
Thank you, Christy.
Yeah. Okay. So everybody, please do put your questions in the Q&A panel, not the chat panel. And we will start out with a question, which, even reading it, has a lot of acronyms in it or things that I don't know about. So I'm looking forward to hearing the answer. Do the regions/kits used to proof detection of 40 to 60 clinical specimens need to have been produced in GMP facilities, or can that be set up in parallel and just proven? Oh, my question got moved. Parallel or just proven on a 40 to 60 clinical specimens one more time.
Yeah, so the only acronym I'm not familiar with, and maybe the person who's asking that question can clarify, is DMC. But
sorry,
I'm
GMP. Sorry.
Oh, GMP. But, so I can answer that. Yeah, so GMP stands for Good Manufacturing Practices. And the interesting point is, in my experience during this EUA process, is that is not needed. So for the benefit of folks maybe not immersed in this particular industry, a typical requirement for all medical devices is good manufacturing practices, and that is a set of policies and procedures with a high level of rigor so that you can to show that you can consistently and safely make a product. And during this emergency use authorization, that's one of the requirements that has been waived. So GMPs have been waived for this process. There are elements of GMPs that will be asked and answered during the EUA, but the GMP process doesn't need to be adhered to the letter.
Yeah. Okay, and there was a clarification. Thanks. Yes, this is intended for Corona and EUA.
Yes, yes. Okay. Now, 99% of the products, the medical devices, drugs, biologics are not going to go through EUA. But if you're in this special window, in this special process, GMPs will be waived.
Okay. The next is, how has the COVID crisis affected the M&A appetite of the large companies?
Yeah. So, you know, I'm going to make an informed I'm going to present an informed position. I would say there's probably a certain level of belt tightening and stretching out of timelines, whether you're an institutional investor or a large strategic. But fundamentally, companies like, and I'm going to quote a few that I'm more familiar with. Our fund has a partnership with Johnson & Johnson. My inclination and my perception is they are going to continue to deploy capital, maybe not at the same clip, but they have a capacity and a long-term view such that they're still going to be looking at deals and doing deals. The diligence may take a different form. The timelines may be stretched out, but they're still in the game. So that's my answer.
Okay, great. And then given delays with running an FDA trial of 60 patients, is a smaller study of 20 patients for an external device of value to early stage investors of worth, or should we just proceed straight on with the original study?
So maybe the person can clarify while I'm answering. Your study is the study is the study. What I mean by that, the FDA either needs a 40-patient study or it doesn't. There's no real titration. Now, maybe the question is, I want to get on the market with a modest study and apply this guidance that says I don't need a 510K. And I think, and the FDA isn't asking me for clinical data, so I'm going to start with this modest clinical data set. But there typically is no option A or option B with the FDA. If you're going through an application process, they're either going to say you need to do a 40 patient study, period. They're not going to say do a 40 patient or 150 patient. Now, if you're not interfacing with the FDA, if you're saying, oh, according to this COVID related guidance, I don't need to submit an application. So my internal validation suggests I need to do a 40 patient study to make these claims, because I'm a wellness device and the FDA has said for certain wellness devices, I don't need to submit an application, then go forth and do it. But if you want to get,
go ahead.
But if you want to get a formal 510K or PMA or de novo, then there will be no ambiguity about the clinical data set needed.
Okay. And just to clarify, it's from FI, if that helps in your question. The name is FAII.
Oh, yeah. We can probably talk offline, Phi, he can rejigger my memory on his specific use case. But I think my feedback still holds. Yeah.
Okay. And there was a clarification. Thanks, Kwame. Investors are now asking for modest clinical data set to secure their investment. We're in agreement with what you're saying, all or nothing for the FDA. So yes. Thank you for that clarification there. Next up is, What is the most common mistake made by companies when engaging with the FDA for the regulatory approval process?
Yeah, so at a very high level, it's incomplete or confusing information. So there's a struggle to provide clear, concise information and guiding the FDA so they can make a judgment. So you'll go through a couple iterations of clarifying before you can actually have enough clear information for them to make a decision. And a certain amount of clarification is normal. And if I could put some rough numbers on it, it's not unusual. If you're making first contact with the FDA and you're an early stage company, it's not unusual to get 3 to 10 clarifying questions on that first submission, that first application, whatever type it is. On the other end of the spectrum, I've seen over 20 questions. And that is a signal that there was a level of ambiguity in the application to start.
Okay. Please discuss FDA's opinions about product claims and marketing in general, an area where startups often get ahead of themselves.
Yeah. So generally speaking, your head of marketing, God bless him or her, is going to want to make the most assertive claim possible. And generally speaking, that is going to require a mix of supporting peer-reviewed literature and analysis potentially of peer-reviewed literature, and I will be candid, prospective clinical data. Let me give you an example. I'm working with a company that wants to create a diagnostic for two well-understood indices in this particular space. And then they have a proprietary software algorithm for two novel indices. And that is going to require validation, which generally requires a prospective clinical data set. So generally speaking, a company in the medical device digital health space underestimates the clinical data needed to support a claim that they want to make for their device. And the interesting times we're living in is the FDA said it, and I'm repeating myself, if you're a certain clinical specialties and you're working on COVID-related solutions, that clinical data set may be less. But the real danger is want to make a claim without adequate clinical data.
We do have time for more questions, so please feel free to put your questions in the Q&A panel. In the meantime, Kwame, do you think with how things have shifted for COVID for the regulatory path, do you see some of that shift continuing after the crisis is over, or do you think it will revert back to how the regulatory process has been in the past?
So, Christy, that's a great question. And I've been thinking about that over the last few weeks. From a public health perspective, I think it will be prudent and the FDA will revert back. So let me tell you how I think that's going to play out. And with the caveat that we've never seen such a relaxation of regulations for moderate risk products ever. There's never been a crisis of this scope and scale. There's always been an emergency use there's been emergency use authorization for years, but not this level of guidance that is adjusting the bar. So I think there's going to be a period where guidance will continue to be promulgated with the requirements for these types of products. At some point, this emergency is going to end. And the FDA will formally come out with either a guidance or series of guidances that lay out a transition plan for the products that are in the market for how they may provide the data that is more commensurate with products as they have been regulated in the past. And there will be some sort of grandfathering in of those products that were operating under EUA That's my educated guess. And then there's going to be a final phase where the normal application type, the 510Ks, all devices are going to have to go through that process. But I don't think this period is going to last forever. And for some, it's a bit of a genie in a bottle or lightning in a bottle that you can be catching.
Fantastic. We did get a few more questions. For non-invasive minimal risk tests that straddles wellness and FDA regulation, can you take a device with a traditional wellness claim intentionally into class one as a differentiator among other wellness products? Flip side, if technology's similar predicate is class two, can you simply adjust the claim back into a wellness or class one territory simply through claims/indications for you?
Yeah, so there are certain, let me take the last one and go to the first one. So the FDA in the cardiovascular space said for certain wearables that are measuring cardiovascular parameters, if you have a cleared device, you can titrate your claims related to COVID and you don't need to submit a new 510K. And it's essentially basically saying, oh, you're kind of titrating. You can get on the market without an application. It's not exactly your question, but it's allowing you to aggressively put new claims on your 510K regulated device without a new 510K. There are also guidances that say for certain specialties, you can be in this wellness space and put on aggressive claims and you don't need to submit a new 510K. And some of the guidances say, oh, you need to have these specific labeling claims on your product. And then FDA will opt to not exercise any post-market compliance activity. So I'm not going to say it depends because that's a bit of a cop-out. Let me say what one would do is look at where their wellness product is, the most closely regulated regulations that fit most closely to them. Look at the guidances that may be appropriate or applicable to them and see, look for the COVID related guidance and look for the examples. And a lot of these guidances, they will give examples of devices and changes they've made that the FDA will not regulate. Or they'll say, look, for these types of devices, as long as you do this type of testing and put this labeling on it, we will not regulate you. So it just requires a little bit of research and hunting of relevant guidance.
Okay, and we have one more question. Please talk about the general investment environment for medical devices. Where are investors focusing their attention and what areas are out of favor? Where is Wademaker focused?
Ooh, so the classic So most medical devices are organized or thought of in terms of specialties, and the top one or two that have been for years and I believe will be are cardiovascular, orthopedics, and ophthalmology. There's opportunity, but it's still a relatively new space where valuations can kind of be all over the map, but it's an exciting opportunity. Is wellness, and we're not playing a lot in the Wademaker is 360 Health is not playing a lot in the wellness space, but we're open to tangential areas. I talked about Advocate, which you can consider a marketplace, and then the new frontier is therapeutics, VR, AR solutions, and we're open to those types of opportunities where there's ample clinical data to support endpoints and claims again. So the obvious examples are the pairs of the world. There's a company called Akili that just launched a wellness product with a certain amount of clinical data. And some of these companies in the VR, AR space are collecting robust clinical data sets to support their claims. And they may be going all over the world to collect the clinical data, but we believe in clinical data. If you're going to make these claims, having said that, WaveMaker 360 Health generally looks at companies where that data set may or may not be needed in their business model to support one or two products so that we can see scaling pretty quickly after our investment. So to recap, cardiovascular, orthopedics, ophthalmology as specialties, interesting areas that we think there's going to be a lot of promise are wellness and digital therapeutics.
Great. Those are all of our questions. Did that bring up anything else for you that you'd like to leave us with before we wrap up? Any other comments?
Well, I would just say by the nature of the questions I heard, this is a savvy group of participants, and partnerships and relationships are key. So I would just encourage them to continue to think about the experts they need on their team to get through these meaningful milestones. And quite candidly, they're thinking about this very critically. So thank you for that. And just continue to keep doing what you're doing. And I want to thank you again, Christy, for this opportunity.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us. And thanks to the team who set this all up. We are very grateful for them. We thank you for walking us through such a technically challenging area in a very informative and concise way. That's really helpful. We will look forward to seeing everybody next week. We are going to have Paul Orlando. He's spoken for us before. He has a really interesting background, and he runs the incubator at USC. He's going to talk about growth in a downturn.
The Friday Coffee Meetup podcast is brought to you by Echo Factory. Learn more about how Echo Factory can help your business achieve rapid, sustainable growth at echo-factory.com and get all the details about upcoming Friday Coffee Meetup episodes at fridaycoffeemeetup.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again next week.